multimedia, if you will,
right,
live on something totally different. And Bill Bissett, he was great. He was, yeah, I wish that was recorded.
Private School, winding up here, did you ever play The Doc, O'Hara's?
Yes.
You know, The Doc. What was The Doc? I'm fascinated
O'Hara's.
By The Doc.
Oh, wonderful. It was a great place to play. It was very cavernous. Of course, it was
a pretty big room.
A huge lobby at one time for boats. But great sound and a lot of Hell's Angels and a lot of fights afterwards and wonderful.
Jimmy, you also went on to Warsaw, the band Warsaw.
Uh-huh.
When you named the band Warsaw, did you know about
it? In the back of my mind, it was there, and I thought, this is such a great name. It needs to be out there again. The visual of the word Warsaw had. Two W's bookending, an S in the middle, and A's on either side of that. It was just like a wonderful name. But unfortunately, a lot of people confused us for Joy Division's early incarnation as Warsaw.
Have you got any Joy Division fans to join the Warsaw legend?
Well, people would buy our records based on the fact that they thought we were Joy Division, but that's as close as we got.
But it isn't really a record. It's a flexi disc.
It's an original flexi.
Which comes back to the reissue of The Private School on Supreme Echo, which is a
flexi.
Flexi disc.
And it's a beautiful yellow flexi, too. You should hang this up or dangle it from your lights. It's absolutely beautiful, transparent yellow.
As well as a booklet and a vinyl record as well.
And a vinyl record.
But winding up here, how did you get on Friends Records, which also was home of Magic Dragon, which Ron Nelson sung for?
And Subhumans. How did we get there? We were just kind of shopping around, and Friends Records, Roy... said, okay, I'll put it out for you. And it was probably a good tax dodge for him or something. And he said he'd distribute it as long as we put his Friend's Hot Wax on the cover, which kind of, it's a pretty shitty logo. It's cut out of, poorly cut out. And anyway, he never gave me the original artwork back. I'm pissed off about that. But, you know, there's other stories about him as well.
And it wasn't just you in the band. There also was Ed Mowbray.
Ed Mowbray. Shout out to Ed. Hope you're listening, man.
Who people can actually see on YouTube because he shot a lot of vids. Like he shot the Marlonettes Barbara video.
Yeah, classic. And he shot World War III DOA. And he shot the Dish Rags.
Yeah, he really raised the bar for locally made music videos.
Good quality.
And that Barbara one for the Marlonettes
it's a classic.
With the editing. I mean, he was already working, I think, at CKVU, so he was from the industry.
Yeah.
What's amazing about that Modernettes video is on YouTube, it lives on, and it's got like 400,000 hits, views. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's been restored. He did a great job. What did you do after Private School? You did Warsaw. What did you do, Walter?
Well, briefly after Flames, I played in a...
Oh, after Flames, yeah.
It was a ska reggae band called The Invaders. And we actually did a gig here, right at UBC, backing up 5440.
There also was the Villains. They were a ska band,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and there was another band called The B-Sides. That, again, was early 80s.
And what about you?
After Warsaw, I formed Paz with Walter's brother, John Makroff, and a couple of other guys. And then after that incarnation, we put out a cassette, which did really well in Japan. And after that, the guitar player left. So we got another guitar player, and we brought Walter in. So we had two drums and two drummers. Nice big sound. And to this very day... Paz still plays together, minus one drummer. But we're still doing it.
Was it hard to release a record in the 1970s, 80s? Like, were record stores receptive to consignment?
No.
What about Charles Bogle Record Dispensary? Do you remember that place?
Oh, yeah. We went up there. Paz went up there. A couple of guys from Paz went up there poking around. And he had a whole bunch of Warsaw flexies behind the glass counter. amongst other beautiful things. And it just looked wonderful in there. And he started talking to us, and I said, yeah, we used to be in a band called Warsaw, and I designed the Flexi cover and all that. And he said, oh, you're in Warsaw? He said, I got a whole bunch of Warsaw Flexis here. Do you want to buy them back?
Did you?
I said, no, you go ahead and sell them.
I have actually bought my records back from stores. When people offer them, I am going to buy them.
Well, I can tell
back.
You this. When Private, and this is in the booklet as well, when Private School EP came out, we got the whole band got one copy each and nothing else. And I think there's about 300 or 500 pressed. So I went to A&A Records on Granville Street and I bought three more. So
yeah.
I bought three of my own records.
Yeah. I mean, you used to get one copy and that's it. You're
yeah.
out the door. But, I mean, you have to think that back then, the big music machine, the radio stations, the corporate sort of rock stations, they didn't want to have anything to do with punk. I mean, God bless CITR, and here we are sitting here in this nice control room with Nardwar, and it's still happening. I mean,
there's still resistance, yeah.
Thank God for UBC and CITR. Thank you, CITR.
Yes.
And winding up here, thank you, Jason Flowers, Supreme Echo. Yay!
Shout out to Jason Flowers.
Jason, could you please explain one more time?
Nardwar.
We have had Private School in the studio today.
Yes, we have.
We played a bit of Flames.
We did.
Not related to your reissue, etc. But you have found Private School. Are you going through the Vancouver Complication record and picking out bands? Because last time
it was
Wasted Lives.
It's
this
true.
This time is Private School.
Okay.
What's next? Witch's Hammer!
Yeah! I'll be back. I can't wait for that one.
And I have a cassette, a rare cassette.
You sure do.
How rare is that cassette that I have?
When you sent me the scan, nothing on the internet looks that crystal clear. Nobody even knows what the cover looks like. I now know what the cover looks like. I mean, because you have that tape. It's rare, and that's going to be a very interesting story to tell. Yeah.
And right coming up, you have a band with a lot of mustaches in it, don't you? You're releasing a band. Plan 9. Yeah.
Not only. You got to look at those tight jeans they're wearing. There's all kinds of funny things going on in those pictures.
And you love the mustaches, like Twitch, etc. You love mustache rock. Like your label is
mustache punk.
Were there any mustaches in
Private School?
There was.
I had a mustache when I joined because I was coming from the jazz world, right? And disco. And we all had mustaches. And Ron said to me one day, he said, you got to lose the mustache.
Ba-boom. And this is coming up on Supreme Echo, the band Plan 9, who are not a Misfits tribute band.
They are not at all.
Are you going to have trouble marketing that?
I don't think so. It's such an unknown oddball one. Really, these other releases that are known are going to really be what promotes that one. It's the Supreme Echo logo that is going to make it sell because there's a reputation attached to it. But that's a really special band. It's a bunch of guys from Toronto that moved to Calgary and formed a band. It's literally a transplant. And it doesn't really sound like anything. I mean, I hear Devo in it a bit, but it's an odd one.
It's not really punk. It's kind of like the Modern Minds doing punk. It's not really punk.
Yeah, the Modern Minds are not punk at all. I mean, it's Moberg doing great, great power pop.
But a special band you have released onto the unsuspecting Vancouver public is Private School. And
yeah.
The reissue of Private School is out now. Jason, one more last time. People can get...
So tomorrow we're going to be at Neptune Records between 1 p.m. and 2:30. Maybe we'll stay a bit longer. It's going to be the best price you'll ever find the double record at. And then that evening, you can also follow up and party down with us. We're going to be at What's Up Hot Dog on East Hastings from 8 p.m. onwards.
Right now, we are going to end with the worst record ever in Vancouver's history. Again, this was in a package that I got from Ken Lester, and it actually was in a Private School folder.
Amazing.
Printed by Dave Gregg.
Yeah.
And actually probably laid out by Ron Nelson.
Yep, and it's the packaging it came in is definitely a Dave Gregg.
And we know the band is called Ayatollah, but is that Dave Gregg on the record, do you think?
It's the height is correct. Blindfolded, then he's got something else on his head, so it's kind of hard to say.
So Ken Lester's choice of the worst record ever from Vancouver, totally undocumented, which we're going to play right now. Anything else, for the first time ever, live.
It's hand-labeled. It looks really weird.
Yeah.
Anything else to add, Walt, about Private School?
Well, it was a quick flash. It all happened so quickly and ended very quickly, but it was really great to be part of the scene from its sort of onset, and just the way, you know, the whole scene came about. It was a magical time in Vancouver.
And what about you, Jamie?
Yeah, I agree. There was so much going on that we didn't all sink in what was happening. And you got recorded. We did this EP, and then the EP was out. And then there were so many other bands and so many other musical directions. Everybody in private school was a true musician, and it was only natural that we went on to do other great musical things.
Why should people care about private school? Why should people care?
Because it was good. The music was great.
It's unique. It really stands out. You can even read, there's a great review which we've reproduced in the booklet, where it just, in that early, those first steps of the punk scene, I just think it's a bit of an anomaly, a good anomaly.
And a shout out to a young Dave Gregg. I just loved playing with that guy. I mean, he was such a nice guy. He was in love with Jimi Hendrix, and you know, he was a happy-go-lucky guy. And it's a shame we don't have him here anymore, but it was always great to see Dave, even years later. There was a groove happening there, and he was a 16-year-old little guitar phenom.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jason and Supreme Echo, for making this Vancouver Nugget available. What is the actual retail price of this online? If people don't get the reissue, the original goes for how much?
Oh, the original is upwards of 300 US. I don't know what. It's a pretty stable at about 300 US. What do you think? Is that about right? Yeah, this is a double 7-inch. It should top out at about $20. It was an expensive package to create.
So right now, we're going to play something totally unrelated to private school. This is Ayatollah, the worst record ever made in Vancouver, according to Ken Lester, who sold me this record, which was in a private school envelope on an Ardoir, the Human Serviette radio show. Of course, yes. And doo-doo-loo-doo.
Doo-doo.
Hello, hello. I am back. I've been away for a couple weeks, This is Isaac, your host of Word on the Street. And we're just going to transition here after Narwhar's show. And to start off the show, I'm going to play a track off of a new record that's come out from a local artist. His name is Boslin. And this album is called Motionless 2. This song is called The Circus. And we're going to start up with this one and tell you a couple things about Boslin, and then we'll get into the show today. This track is called The Circus. And just an explicit warning on this one. Enjoy.
I see the realest fakes, gestures that move like snakes. Old friends be in the way, I duck like Sugar Ray. These cons can't hide the shame, that circuit jiggy fame. Broke niggas think I'm lame, their bitches scream my name. Like round and round we go, I want shots and shots patrol. I need love and love some more, yeah. Like round and round we go, up and downs in life I know. Nights no more, yeah. Like lustre with my love, like lustre with my hate. You took away my trust, he took away my waste. Both you can watch me glow, both you can watch my fate. I'm out to get the pay, these cats just want the fame. I juggle dedication with depression, I could not explain. I hustle from the basement, count your blessings or else you will pay. I struggle with complacence, learn some lessons in my life today. I use my imperfections as my weapon, what else can I say?
Round and round we go, I want shots and shots patrol. I need love and love some more, yeah. Hey, hey. And round and round we go, can't keep up with nights no more. I need love and love some more, yeah.
If you really hate me, why call back? I'm out to get the cake, bitch, she live inside the past. Trying to keep it straight, see, I talk facts. Bitches that will pay me, baby, come and last. Ay, boy, I just keep it real, it's so surreal. I'm zooming in the coupe for real, like what's the deal? Shout out to Q and friends for real, my nigga still. Stay independent, fuck a deal, I'll make it real, real, real. Like round and round we go,
like round and round.
I want shots and shots patrol,
shots and shots.
I need love and love some more. Like round and round we go,
like round and round
and downs in life I know.
End up and down,
can't keep up with nights no more.
Can't keep up, no.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome to Motionless 2. Shout out fucking S Beyond. Shout out Moose Stew. Shout out Isaac, fucking shout out Wonga, shout out Rico, shout out all my niggas. Motionless 2, motherfucker.
Hello, we're back. That was a track by Boslin that was called The Circus, and he has a new project called Motionless 2. And if you're around UBC tomorrow at the Frats by any chance, you can catch him doing a performance. He will be at Kappa Sigma at Coachella at that party. So if you want to check him out, he'll be there. And stay tuned for some stuff I'll be doing with those guys. I'll have them over here at the station over the next couple weeks. Be doing an interview with Boslin. So stay tuned for that. Now we're just going to play a couple messages before we get into the show. And since it was legalization day in Canada on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about drugs and drug culture with music. So if you want to hear about that, stay tuned.
I'm still in luck. I'm going to be something. I'm going to be something. This love was tainted. I don't need nothing from you.
Achtung, Achtung, alarm.
Have you ever thought about going abroad to study, work, intern, or learn a language? Mark Sunday, October 21st in your calendar and get down to the Vancouver Convention Center East Building to find out how. All the experts under one roof. Top universities, gap year specialists, and student travel organizations. Feature seminar on scholarships starts at noon and expo opens at 1 p.m. Admission is free. Check online at studyandgoabroad.com for more info.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people. And today, we're going to be talking about drug culture and music. So does anyone want to share their piece to start off, their thoughts on that? I know we have a lot of points people want to get across. No? Anyone want to start? Am I starting then? Okay. So, drugs are in a lot. It's good timing, right? Drugs are involved in a lot of different music genres. As you know, if you listen to any music, you've heard a reference somewhere. So what I want to talk about was hip-hop culture with drugs. And I'm not just going to talk about weed or coke. I'm just going to talk about it overall. And I found this very good article from Genius. So courtesy to Genius for this. Drug culture with hip-hop actually started in the 80s. And it wasn't, oh, let's do a bunch of drugs. It was actually, don't do cocaine because it's bad. And this message was made by guys like Melly Mel and Kumul D. And if you listen to hip-hop, if you know the history of hip-hop, these are some of the pioneering guys of the genre. So it started off, yeah.
And like Grandmaster Flash with like yeah. white lines and the message and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. So people like that were actually saying no to drugs. And compared to now, you know, a lot of people generalize hip-hop and have been for the past 20, 25 years, like, oh yeah, don't listen to it because it's going to make you do drugs or it's violent or this and that, right? So it actually began with the opposite message and it kind of got the wrong message across when it came to the mainstream media, when it came to the forefront of culture. And then in the 90s, despite that, we just took over completely and it was, yeah, you know, Snoop Dogg, as we know, as we played the ad, Dr. Dre, who titled his first album The Chronic. It was very pro-weed. And then in the early 2000s, it moved toward lean. And for those of you who listen to Travis Scott, if you know that new song on his album, Rest in Peace to DJ Screw, that's because DJ Screw actually overdosed on lean. So it's a reference back to that. So a lot of the history in contemporary hip-hop with someone like Travis Scott, someone from Houston, has a lot to do with the culture, with lean, and with MDMA, and the sort of issues around drug culture. And it's not as obvious as it seems. Like, a lot of people, again, who listen to hip-hop think it's just enforcing the use of drugs when it's actually trying to socially tackle against that. Like, in the late 2000s, again, it's pretty conflicting because there's people like Jay-Z who are saying, oh, don't do drugs like MDMA. And then there's Trinidad James who has a record like Molly, which goes platinum. So it's very, you know, both ends, both sides. And then, as we know, more recently, the past couple of years, Xanax has been a huge problem. We've had Lil Peep overdose. We've had other rappers overdose, despite the encouragement and use of these drugs. So what do you guys think about all of this? What do you think about drug culture and hip-hop?
I was just going to say, like, it's interesting that hip-hop gets, like, especially a bad rap about about drug culture and, like, incorporating it into their music, when I feel like every major genre has their, like, typical substance. Like, if you think about, like, psychedelic music and psychedelics or, like, country music and alcohol. Like, I know alcohol, to a lot of people, isn't considered a real drug, but it's just as harmful as a lot of other things and has ruined as many lives. So like, I feel like every genre has their vice in a way, and it's just kind of unfair that people choose to target hip hop as like the ultimate like bad, I don't know, influence like on kids when they could get it anywhere. And there's a lot of hip hop, as you just mentioned, like going against that and like encouraging people to like go through other things. So I don't know. I feel like it's just a bias that exists.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's really, really interesting how with hip-hop, it's like when people think of hip-hop, it's like very heavily associated with weed and like other drugs, whereas a lot of the other genres, like you don't immediately think of like, I don't know, Fleetwood Mac and go like, yeah, cocaine. Like it's, I don't know. It seems unfair.
Yeah, and going way back, jazz has a really long history with drugs too, especially heroin. Somebody who I thought of was Charlie Parker. I've been to like the Club Berlin a few times in New York, which is like a namesake for him. Not the original one. It's a new one that's come up. And it's just really unfortunate. Like a quote from an article is that, you know, his life was riddled with depression and heroin addiction, and the addiction caused him to miss performances and be considered unemployable. And heroin use was just like rampant in the jazz scene, and users could acquire it with like little difficulty. So it's just always been present, and it just like leads to points about how it's like creativity and drugs especially, and music and drugs, are just always intertwined in some way.
Yeah, for sure. I think another example of that where it kind of impacted the artist's life in such a way was Syd Barrett from Pink Floyd. If you know any history about Pink Floyd, Syd Barrett was sort of one of the founding guys, even though he didn't exist. He virtually didn't exist during the whole era when they got really big, like during Dark Side of the Moon, The Wall, Wish You Were Here, all of that. He was very mentally ill partially because he wasn't mentally healthy in the first place, but he did a lot of acid and he developed schizophrenia. And not to say that's always the case with everyone. I mean, it's very dependent on who the individual is, but it's just another time where it went and it crossed the line and it ruined that person's career. And I think also with hip-hop, bring that up again, I think the problem is, and this could be in other genres too, as soon as people just hear the language around the drugs or they hear words they're talking about the drugs, they think, okay, they're just promoting the use of drugs. But with something like hip-hop, a lot of the times it's actually not promotion. It's supposed to be activism for against, and how that impacts the people, and how a lot of the people who are rapping about that or singing about that have been impacted by that in a negative way. I know with you two, with Isaiah and Shaylin, like, we have that class, Anthro, and we've been learning a lot about the war on drugs. And I think it's the same kind of thing where, you know, it's the same kind of blame game as a means to promotion, but it's really supposed to bring across a message like, hey, this is my struggle. Just in hip-hop, there are a lot of messages of struggle and trauma and difficult upbringings. It's just another way, oh, this wasn't something I want to talk about, but I feel like I have to talk about it because it's the only thing I know, because dealers were the only people around me that were role models, because drugs were the only thing in my economy that kept it going. It's those kinds of things, why they feel like they need to talk about this.
Yeah, and there's a quote from Straight Outta Compton where I believe Ice Cube's character says, it's like he's being criticized for his music, like promoting like gang culture and drug culture, and he says, our art is a reflection of our reality, which just like nicely sums up like what Isaac just said.
Yeah, especially when Lil Pump's lean costs more than my rent. It's a lot in their lives. But kind of going back to that, it's involved in their lives and they want to talk about like its repercussions. But then there's all like the party songs where they're not talking about its repercussions. They're talking about like what it does to them and how it makes the party scene so much better. Like just look at Sicko Mode with a Travis Scott song where Drake says, I just took a Xan, had me out like a light. Like 13 hours till I land, had me out like a light. And so
the only song where they talk about drug use like responsibly wasn't like everyone making fun of Drake.
Yeah, because it was like because he was talking about it because he was anxious on the plane. I think it's still funny, but
yeah,
I see your point though.
Yeah, it was just kind of like a lot of really good artists will talk about its implications on their life and why they talk about it and its effects. But then some artists just use it as a way to get attention and get a hit.
Yeah, for sure. Anyone else have anything to say on this right now? No? What do we think about, like, kind of what you were saying, like, mumble rap? I know you were making this point earlier. That it's kind of, like, part of the persona and, like, the tone of voice. Do you guys think that it's something that is okay to use drugs as like a part of someone's persona or like their characteristics as a music personality, or is that something that you should try to do through a different medium?
Yeah, I think it's like it's quite common, and we shouldn't feel the need to say this, but yeah, I still feel the need to say it's like doing drugs and doing what everybody else does isn't a personality. And I feel like a lot of people like kind of like use that as like, oh, like they'll say things, they'll paraphrase what other people are saying and just like, oh, this is my hype, this is my thing. And it's like some of the like the qualities, like beyond the actual content of mumble rap, it's like what you're hearing, like that like voice that's just like really loud. It's kind of like, it sounds like aloof, it sounds apathetic, it sounds dissociated, it sounds kind of like drugged out. It's just like connected to all those things.
What do you guys think about the drug schedule. We have it here on the dock. Do you think it's coincidental that a lot of the drugs, they're Schedule 1, that is highest priority?
Nope.
In terms of...
Definitely
in terms
not
of
coincidental.
Do you think, it's coincidental...
Absolutely not.
...that those are all the drugs that are used in music? What do you think about that?
Is this for Canada or for the U.S., these schedules?
Oh, yeah. So the schedule here, we have listed as Schedule 1 being... in the United States, marijuana, heroin, LSD, ecstasy, magic mushrooms. And then Schedule 2 is cocaine, meth, oxy, Adderall, Ritalin, and Vicodin. I don't know if it's just me, but there appears to be a bit of a discrepancy between these two things. And it's like what we've been talking about before, like things like weed, heroin, LSD, ecstasy. If we think we can associate different music scenes and music genres with all those things, and through that you could associate counterculture movements with all of these things, which may be more so why there's such a negative perception of them and why the government is more so against it in the States.
Yeah, and like if you look at a lot of the Schedule 1 drugs, it could be who, like what demographic those drugs are associated with. Like Schedule 2 cocaine being a Schedule 2 drug is just insane to me. And meth, like I know, both of those surprise me a lot. And like if you think about who does cocaine, it's like a rich drug. And I don't know, this ties to our anthro classes you were talking about, and like there's so much you could talk about in terms of like who they choose to criminalize more for like what possession of what drugs. But there's like a lot of politics involved, and it's not like a random, just logical.
It's not just by chance.
Yeah.
It's systematic.
Or even just by like potency. It's like a lot of social aspects go into what they criminalize higher.
I'd love to see what year these were like classified as scheduled. Like when was LSD classified as Schedule 1, marijuana classified as Schedule 1, and kind of see throughout the years through like 60s and 70s the psychedelic movements. Maybe LSD would come up there with all like the acid going around. And then like you said, the war on drugs, where all the rappers started to promote the use of weed in their music. Maybe that's when it was classified as Schedule 1, if anyone knows that answer, chip in.
Yeah, I'm not so sure how to answer that question, but I find it interesting that Adderall, Ritalin, and not so much Vicodin, but to like ADHD, like a lot of prescription medications are like climbing, and obviously not in the legal context where somebody is given those medications for a particular condition, but it just shows that it's like this is like rising up as like an issue. And I believe it's predominantly amongst like white, like middle class, like young people, which could explain why it's not at the top. And then also another point is that like meth, amphetamine, of course, is like also associated with like lower class white people, which could be why it's not like, I'm not like necessarily saying that that's why, but it could contribute to the fact that it's not necessarily class one.
I think there's also a big hypocrisy between the drugs that are classed as like Schedule 1, Schedule 2 substances that happen to be the ones that are in music and hip hop, and the ones that are actually equally as harmful are prescription medication that are not classified as Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, what are available over the counter, that probably do the most damage to people, because you can see the effects after someone, you know, is off their meds. It's just pretty crazy. Yeah, I mean, Xanax is a prescription, but a lot of prescription medications as well aren't listed as substance as scheduled drugs, but they're openly readily available, and they're just as bad. Like, if you've ever watched a commercial or trailer with, like, trying to promote a drug, it just goes on and on and lists all the bad side effects, and then you start to wonder why this is even, you know, legal. So
I kind of like that point about the accessibility of like the over-the-counter, but earlier you mentioned the drug like alcohol and how hip-hop always gets a bad rep for the drugs that they promote, but country music is never criticized for alcohol, because it is you can't have the Super Bowl without country music and a Budweiser commercial. So what do you guys think about that? Should country music be criticized because of alcohol's prevalence in it, promotion?
I think it should, but I think to me it's pretty obvious why it isn't. I think this has a lot to do with the States being very racially divided. Not to generalize, but most people who make country and listen to country are Caucasian, and then most people who make hip hop are African American, even though the demographic of hip hop is very, very diverse across North America, at least who's listening to it now. It's the most popular genre, but I think it has a lot to do with that racial history in the States. white people who are making country music aren't going to get discriminated against, but African Americans who, you know, are talking about hip hop and they people are saying, oh, it's promoting violence and drugs, they're going to get the attention just due to the racial ties and the grassroots of that. And like, that's very unfortunate, but that's a big problem that stays still. I mean, look at who the president is. Like, we know that's not something that's an issue of the past. It's still very contemporary, still today.
Yeah, and kind of beyond and involved in like what we're talking about is also that just has to do with culture. Like, alcohol is such a culturally accepted drug that most people do not even think of it as a drug. Whereas you have something like marijuana that's like, you know, less like culturally accepted, that is of course changing. It's like that wouldn't be perceived the same way. It just depends like which culture uses what drug, and then it involves changing the culture, you know, as has been discussed in like anthropology, to like fix people's opinions on the drug. Caffeine and sugar as well.
Yeah, it's definitely relative to the culture that you're in. Like we were talking about on Thursday in our anthro class, like shout out to Wave Davis for coming in and talking to us about entheogens, or as you probably know them, psychedelics or hallucinogens. How in other cultures, those are totally pretty much like equivalent to something like caffeine or nicotine. Like those are very sacred things, even religious things, and it just depends on the culture, right? But especially since the war on drugs has been fueled in the past 30-40 years, the norms in North America, especially the United States, it's so anti-drug. Like, this is gonna like kill your kids, this is gonna make them do bad things. Like, I know we watched an ad from like the 20s, like that's way before. Yeah, there's like a trailer for this movie about weed, and it's like anti-weed, and it was really ironic because the girl like smoking a cigarette, and then it's like, take that harmless cigarette away from your daughter, and then she's gonna get this marijuana cigarette, and then she starts smoking it, and then it, like, to us, I mean, now it's hilarious because we know, okay, it doesn't make us do these things that they show in the ad. They show like this girl like going crazy, like on like like runs of like oh, like she can't like help herself from like going around like sexually, and she's like gonna start doing other drugs, and she's gonna like jump out her window and like, kill all these people.
Like, and funny also to note, this girl is portrayed as like manically playing the piano. It's like this association with like music and drugs is out of
control. It's still there. Yeah, but okay, when we talk about drugs, why do we think that drugs are in music so much? Like, what are reasons besides, okay, I want to be an activist and represent against it? Why are drugs actually used with music in a positive way?
Drugs are everywhere, especially in the music scene. I think we were talking earlier about festivals before the show. I was like, can you remember the last music festival you were at where there weren't drugs being distributed, right? And when you're the artist and you're surrounded by drugs so frequently, and they're so accessible with all the money you have and the people you surround yourself with, and just the party environment that you're around every single day when you're on tour, how can you not talk about it? Because if, as an artist, you're supposed to write about your life, write about your experiences, how can you criticize somebody for talking about drugs and parties when every single night they're playing stadiums and there's drugs everywhere and it's just one giant party?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if we talked about it on this show or where I heard about this from, but there was a certain music festival that actually incorporated like a safe drug testing program. It may have been Way Home.
Also, Oshiega this summer had a lot of drug testing stations.
Yeah, and I think that's like a smart way to go about it, because telling people to not do drugs never gonna work. It pretty much never works.
What? And it sounds it sounds like harm reduction, like we talk about in class.
Yeah, exactly. And like people used it. There was like big lines, and it probably made for a much safer festival, and especially environment with so many people and big crowds. Like, pretty awful stuff could happen if like no one notices that you're ODing or like something crazy is happening to you. So I feel like it's a good approach that a lot of festivals are taking right now to kind of help the problem rather than ignore it and, like, tell people to stop.
But also, like, music festivals, like, summer music festivals are super dangerous with drugs because, like, I'd say probably the most prevalent one would be, like, ecstasy. And, like, that raises your internal body temperature to, like, a dangerous amount. So with the sunlight, with dancing all day, and again with raves, like, it's just, like, there needs to be a lot of systems in place to protect people, because it's like probably the most dangerous situation which you would be doing a drug, and that's the most prevalent situation which people are doing this drug.
Yeah, and it's just unfortunate. It's like something like MDMA probably is so popular because it makes like all of the great things about a concert just like all that more like evident and intense. Like if like some of the like known effects of the drug would be like you become more like connecting to people, like you're happier, you're like really enjoying the music, like you have like more vivid sensations. It's like the perfect drug for that environment of music.
Very true.
So should just because like the drugs amplify the experience of the music, do you think that musicians should be like encouraging that, like through their songs, or like discouraging that, or how do you think as a musician the audience should experience the music the best way they can?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. And as like Wade Davis alluded to in a lecture that we experienced,
Wade Davis.
Go Hope you're listening. Davis. He spoke about a point where it's like there's this universal thing like within all cultures and all peoples, just this need to like transcend like the dull surroundings, like whether you're a baby like spinning around on a chair trying to get like, you know, one of those like happy head rush things, or you're running around playing with your friends, or you're like just so happy that you feel overcome with like a brain chemical, or you're doing drugs, or you're listening to your favorite music. It can all be connected as this same like just like high and exhilaration above what we're normally doing. So I think that these things, like regardless of whether musicians should promote them or not, because of course there are many dangers associated, but they work in tandem with each other in a way that I think many people are attuned to, even if they're not consciously aware of it.
Yeah, for sure. I think that if you go to a concert and you're passionate about music and you care about that artist, you can definitely get a sort of quote-unquote high from just going to that. You don't need something else in your body to get that, because if you really have that emotion toward it, you don't need anything else to get there, right? But I also think that, I mean, marijuana is legal in Canada now, so I think like it's totally appropriate to talk about. Not like we want to completely advocate for anything, but I'm just reading here, just scientifically, there are certain types of cannabis that produce the desired effect while you're listening to music, so that it actually will sound better. So I'm just, as I go along here, it says there's a balance between two key compounds that are THC and CBD, and they influence the desire for music and its pleasure. So there actually can be benefits to using and listening, but it's not necessary, right? I think just following up on that, the point that you made, Gabe, like, I don't think you can necessarily promote it unless you can justify how it's helped you. And I don't think you can just promote it like without having a rationale for it. You have to have a claim as to why it's important to you or why you need to talk about it.
I think artists do have a social responsibility, but at the same time, I don't think these musicians are like sitting in their, I don't know, jam spaces and like, oh, this song's going to make everyone want to do drugs. It's just like part of their life, so they sing about it just because people write about what they are. So like, I get the social responsibility, but I don't think it is as much of like a purposeful like attempt to like influence the kids to do bad things. It just happens because people are influenced by like the artists they respect. But it is like people should be able to do what they want, but also there is like a social effect, so it's a tricky situation to like handle. I don't think it's like very black and white with like, oh, this drug is can be safe, so it's okay to promote it, or this is like always harmful, so you can't sing about it. It's like more complicated than that.
I think also it's not necessarily the artist's responsibility for that music to even be listened to by like, say, kids.
True,
like
the parents
yeah, or whoever is looking over the
parental
kid. Like,
guidance.
But how does that work with the internet? Like, hard to.
It's so hard now.
Yes, yeah, so
no
real answer.
Even
such a big deal in the 80s, and people were selling CDs, and you know, all these adults were getting mad. I think that's when the whole like law was passed that you have to say something with parental guidance, because parents were getting so upset with all like the punk and the rap and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why there's the explicit warning sticker on certain records, but
yeah, now I think it's just like saturated to a degree where you can't have that level of control, and people can kind of accept that.
And I know a lot of music nowadays is written and composed in a way, and not even just nowadays, but throughout time. Look back at the psychedelic bands in the 70s, where they try to replicate the sound and yes. the feelings of that high. That's why there's like, if you talk to anybody who's a stoner, they'll say, oh yeah, this is my best high playlist, and it'll just be the grooviest tunes to listen to, because it just sets you in that mood. I know you were thinking about artists. Do you want to take over that?
Sure. Yeah, like, I know Still Woozy, they, like, in an interview, they talk about how they're, like, their music is, like, actively trying to replicate the feeling of, like, coming down from, like, an acid high. So, it's, yeah, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. And, yeah, and it also ties into, like, the whole question of, like, how useful and influential are drugs with bands, like, creating music? Like, does it promote creativity? Like, the actual, like, if the bands are so heavily influenced by drugs and that helps them to be creative enough to, like, create this music, do they have a responsibility to like say that this drug helped?
I'm not sure about the responsibility for like giving credit to the drugs, but I've heard a lot of interesting stories about people who think that getting high on a drug and like making art will make it better, but it was great when they were high, but once they came down from the high, they realized their art was crap. Like, I have my dad's friend is a like illustrator, and this happened to him. So it's like an interesting concept that like drugs can make your art better. And I don't know if that's necessarily like it probably works for some people because it like relaxes them or like gets them out of their head. But like, I don't know. It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, and not even necessarily making the art better, but expanding your mind in ways that allow you to like perceive things differently and create other things.
But then I think that's where addiction kind of sets in, because you can use the excuse of, oh, I'm using the drug to push the music. But then when does that cross into using the music to push the experience of the drug, right? When are you writing? When are you high and writing? And when are you writing for when you are high, right? And so people can keep catching. Anyone want to hop on that idea?
Well, I think that if the artist is struggling with addiction, that adds like a whole new layer to the music, which honestly, like, I don't know, I think some of the best albums are just people struggling with addiction. Like even Florence and the Machine's latest album, like all about recovery, and it just adds another layer to the music.
Yeah, one person that this might not have worked for, even though it would in the beginning, is Amy Winehouse, who I know we've like talked about in like past weeks. It's just really sad that this, like, her alcohol, heroin, and cocaine addiction actually represents like the downfall of her career. And I know the media especially like harped on that, so everyone's perception is a little bit blown out of proportion in that area. But it's like, you know, this person, like, what, like, she used like marijuana and she used alcohol like throughout the beginning of her career, and it's like she had like a lot of like angst, and she like mentioned stuff like that, but then it actually just, like, it was, like, part of her creative vice. It was part of who she was, and then it went downhill.
Got a few minutes left. Does anyone want to make any last comments on this topic? It's not going to be the conclusion forever, but just for today.
Yeah, sure. I just want to talk a little bit about not only the drugs that you're taking, but also the drugs that are natural in your body. I mean, it's so hard to say that, you know, doing these kind of drugs is not a part of music or art or culture, because naturally, you know, for people that love doing certain things, it produces a high for them naturally, regardless of what drug they're on. You know, you have your dopamine levels that you know, your serotonin, your dopamine that goes up when you're doing something you love, when you're doing sports, when you're. So it's so hard to say that drugs are not a part of society as a whole, and to say that, you know, hip hop, for example, what we're talking about, you know, is so intertwined with drugs. I'm not just hip-hop, I think everything is intertwined with drugs. It's just the level of drugs there is. What do you guys think?
I think that's really interesting, because like music in a way does kind of mimic like the feeling of being high. I know it's like a very prevalent form of drug or like addiction therapy. Like music therapy is really used because like people love music. It can mimic a lot of the feelings of being actually high on the drug that they're addicted to.
I think that's going to do it for today, at least. Maybe we'll come back on this another time. We'll see. We're going to close off with a couple songs. What do you want to play?
Okay, there's this cover of Mamma Mia by this guy named Austin Weber, and it's recorded in a river in Japan. It's
in a lake.
One, is it a lake or a river?
I don't know.
Is Anyways, it underwater?
Or? No, he's like in a river. He's like, the title of the video is I flew to Japan to film this cover of Mamma Mia. It's so good. So okay. I'm playing that. And maybe okay. other songs, but they aren't as important.
Okay. This has been Word on the Street. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
I've been cheated by you since I don't know when. So I made up my mind, it must come to an end. Look at me now, will I ever learn? I don't know how, but I suddenly lose control. There's a fire inside my soul. Just one look and I can hear a bell ring. One more look and I forget everything. Whoa, whoa, Mamma Mia, here I go again. My, how could I resist ya? Mamma Mia, does it show again? My, just how much I missed ya. Let you go, Mamma Mia. Now I really know why I could never let you go. I've been angry and sad about the things that you do. So I made up my mind to tell you that we're through. But when you go, when you slam the door, I think you know that I won't be away too long. You know I'm not that strong. Just one look and I can hear a bell ring. One more look and I forget everything. Whoa, whoa, Mamma Mia, here I go again. My, how can I resist ya? Mamma Mia, does it show again? My, just how much I missed ya. Yeah, I've been broken hearted. Blue since the day we parted. Why did I ever let you go? Mamma Mia, even when I say bye-bye, take me now or never. Mamma Mia, it's a game we play.
Hello. Just one more thing before we go off for this week. This is another song from Boslin. His album Motionless 2 just came out yesterday, and you could catch him tomorrow at the Frats, if you want, at the Coachella party. I'll be doing an interview with him over the next couple weeks, and this is his song IGB, and there's some swears in this one, so just an explicit warning. Thank you. See you next week.
Nights come to morning, this life keeps on moving away. I feel your sorrow, those bottles are hollow today. Young and so helpless, don't ask me for much, cause I'm broke. I'm saying fuck it, I'm stealing.
I'm still in luck, and I'm gonna be something.
I'm gonna be something.
I'm saying fuck it. I'm still in luck, and I'm gonna be something.
I'm gonna be something.
This love was tainted. I don't need nothing from you, but you can just keep it. Yeah. I'm so caught up in these moments, yeah, yeah. I'm so caught up in these moments, yeah, yeah. I can't fall to these commands.